From the Sky News Centre at 6, a 2-year-old boy suffered serious head injuries after the pram he was in was hit by a lorry. Police are appealing for witnesses to the collision in Oldham in Greater Manchester this lunchtime. This local businessman says it's a notorious stretch of road.
It's a very, very, very dangerous junction because at the moment, some of my elderly customers, I have to escort them across this road.
The UK economy grew at a faster rate in the second quarter of this year than in any other quarter over the last 9 years. The Office for National Statistics has posted growth of 1.2% between April and June. A government minister's announced he's separated from his wife and is coming to terms with his homosexuality. Crispin Blunt, the Tory MP and prisons minister, says there's no one else involved and has appealed for his family's privacy to be respected. A mother who nursed her premature baby back from the dead has been describing how she refused to give up on him. When Kate Ogg gave birth to twins in Sydney in March, the little boy Jamie was pronounced dead by doctors. After 2 hours of cuddling his body to say goodbye, he began breathing. Professor Nina Modi, an expert in neonatal medicine, says warmth and comfort from the mother may have helped.
I've certainly seen instances where babies respond very, very, very positively to being touched. And that's why it's one of the things we encourage mums and dads to do, which is hold their babies close, touch them, stroke them, talk to them.
In cricket, Jonathan Trott and Stuart Broad have been the heroes for England on day two of the final test with Pakistan at Lord's. They've rescued an innings which had the hosts on 47 for 5 at one point. Broad has hit his first ever century while Trott is well beyond his 100. A short time ago, the hosts were 290 for 7 in their first innings. And in showbiz, former housemates Victor Abuja and Michelle Bass re-enter the Big Brother house tonight. It's the first eviction from the Ultimate show this evening too. Either Coolio or John McCririck will get the boots. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Your Learning ESOL course
invites you to improve your English language and learn more about
British legal system,
welfare benefits,
education,
employment rights.
Study ESOL through the radio every Wednesday, Thursday and Friday from 7 o'clock.
To receive your free ESOL workbook and join this course, please call 0751 991 7491 and leave your name and number.
The Your Learning team are waiting to hear from you today.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Lib Dem leader Nick Clegg has been put in charge of the country, acting Prime Minister, while David Cameron is away, and he came to Bristol last weekend to show us what he's made of. We, courtesy of sister programme Dialects, John Peters Coleman, have an exclusive interview with Lib Dem party leader and acting PM Nick Clegg. And more deadly bombs in Iraq killed dozens more Iraqis. Now, this is happening almost every week. Who is planting these bombs? We hear from Bristol Iraqi Sammy Veliola. But first, this week we've seen revelations in the national press about an apparent Catholic priest actually planting an IRA bomb back in 1972. This raises the obvious question about whether the office of the church has been abused in this or possibly other cases. Also, there's the question of the timing of the release of this information from nearly 40 years ago, just before the Pope visits Britain. Anyway, I'm joined by Drive Times reporter Richard Cowley, who is himself a soldier from the Parachute Regiment, who served in Northern Ireland. Hi, Richard, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello there, Tony.
Now, first of all, Richard, what happened in Clawdy in 1972?
July the 31st, 1972, which is actually known as Bloody Monday, believe it or not, but it's a very significant event where three car bombs simultaneously went off. It's a small village called Clawdy in County Londonderry, and it was the scene of a bomb attack where the first of three car bombs exploded outside a local pub, followed minutes later by the other two car bombs outside the post office and a hotel called the Beaufort Hotel, where nine people died and 30 people were injured. Of those nine people, five were Catholics and four Protestants, and also three of the nine were young children, and they all died as a result of a no-warning car bomb, which is unusual, that exploded along the main street of Clawdy on the 31st of July, 72.
So, what's the recent news we hear about a cover-up by the British government?
This basically revolves around Cardinal William Conway of the Catholic Church, who represented Northern Ireland at the time, and MP William Whitelaw, sometimes known as Willie Whitelaw, if you remember that, then the Northern Ireland Secretary, and who later became Deputy Prime Minister for the British government. They colluded additionally with top RUC police officers, or should I say conspired, to essentially avoid the process of law. They admit to this in the police ombudsman's latest report. But they say that this was done, and I'm just going to question this, that this was done to protect Catholic priests from potentially becoming targeted by loyalists in the future. The investigation sought to determine whether a Catholic priest, in this case, Father James Chesney, was a suspect in that 1972 Claudie bombing.
Okay, so what was going on in 1972 then between the British government and the Catholic Church, if anything?
Well, in 72, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, Chief Constable Graham Shillington at the time, is said to have conspired with the MP, William Whitelaw of Northern Ireland, and Cardinal Conway to cover up something. And that was that this Catholic priest, Father Chesney, was supposed to be involved with the Claudie bombing in 1972. They then, because of that, the church agreed to spirit Father Chesney away from Claudie in Londonderry, and indeed out of Northern Ireland into a county called County Donegal. That was nevertheless not done until 1973, and he was moved three times after the bombing, but eventually he ended up in Donegal, where he in fact later died in 1980.
Now, I do find it surprising that the Northern Ireland Secretary was involved in moving him around. But anyway, was there any evidence of Father Chesney's guilt?
The answer to that is, in my opinion, having studied this, I can't see any. So I'd have to say not really or no. It isn't possible to even come close, really, to suggesting that the police have obvious evidence. And the IEC wanted to arrest the father, Chesney, on suspicion of masterminding the entire bombing. And they accused him later of being the quartermaster of the South Derry Brigade, which was, you know, seems a bit odd. But the evidence at the time, to answer the question, that associated Chesney, or Father Chesney, with the bombing, unfortunately, rather resembles idle gossip rather than significant evidence. What happened is, in that 2002, former PSNI Assistant Chief Constable Sam Kincaid reviewed original RUC investigation reports, and he had to admit, having done so, that there was very serious deficiencies in that investigation. Mr. Kincaid then had to apologise for how the police had handled the investigation in 1972. His inquiries then prompted a reinvestigation by the police ombudsman Al Hutchinson, acting in that capacity. The assistant chief constable, Mr. Kincaid, his discoveries are nevertheless now confirmed by the police ombudsman, Mr. Hutchinson.
So
there's no doubt about that.
Okay, so what about the IRA? Did they ever admit that Father Chesney was involved in this operation in Claudie?
Well, I've downloaded something here, as a matter of fact, from Wikipedia, where it says that the Provisional IRA issued an immediate denial of responsibility. The IRA later claimed that they had also conducted an internal court inquiry, or an inquiry, an internal court of inquiry, and had found that its local unit in Derry did not carry out the attack. Another response from the IRA was that former IRA explosives officer Sean Paul O'Doherty who was active in Derry area at that time in the mid-70s, said that he had not heard any mention of the priest's name at the time either. O'Doherty told the Irish News that, in his opinion, journalists appear to have mistaken intelligence reports for hard evidence, which adds up, I think, in this case.
Well, it's very difficult, isn't it, when both sides are denying to actually make any decisions. But what information, then, do you think contributed towards the police being so certain that Father Chesney was a prime suspect in this case?
There was a retired special branch officer at the time who was on the case, and he said that he relied only on good sources within the Provisional IRA in South Derry at the time. But I wonder if they are ever misleading, you know, by any chance. In fact, the only real evidence that Father Chesney was involved was submitted by two people in particular, and that was an MP, Ivan Cooper, and later a letter that recently came to light by Father Liam, who's another priest. Ivan Cooper was the MP at the time for the SDLP group and describes himself as being a moderate Protestant with Stormont, and he says that he was a personal witness to the fact that he saw Father Chesney drive a car, or one of the three cars at the time, and he saw him park it there, and then he went on that basis to the police. He then he also said that because he had offices at the time in Clawdy acting as an MP, some person that he has not named and still is nameless came to his office like a scared rabbit, to quote, and also confirmed that it was the IRA or Father Chesney that did this, that was responsible. Now, the second equally unreliable witness is in the shape of a letter that was written by Father Liam, who has not yet, he has not yet been identified in any way, name or address. So, you know, is that admissible? But nevertheless, he says that he met Chesney, Father Chesney, at a house in Malin Head, which is in County Donegal, in 72. And when the county, when the Father Chesney, who was then the curate, broke down, he confessed to him his role in the bombing. But in the letter, Father Liam says that he specifies that it's a John Chesney in the letter. He doesn't actually say in the letter that he's referring to Father James Chesney. So obviously the church have replied on that, and they've said that quite rightly they've questioned the letter's credibility, pointing out a number of inconsistencies and also glaring inaccuracies. So obviously, you know, they didn't agree with the letter, and that's the only evidence apart from something that the later happened, where the police discovered they searched Chesney's car 2 weeks apparently after the bombing, and they say that they found evidence or traces of explosives in Father Chesney's car. And so what I'm saying is that we'd need to see that substantiated, as the forensic evidence within perhaps recently submitted documents that have obviously come into the hands of the police ombudsman, Al Hutchinson, recently. And the last bit of flimsy evidence was a statement that was actually made by Cardinal Conway himself, who informed William Whitelaw that he knew Father Chesney to be a very bad man, I quote, unquote. So, you know, what exactly does that mean? And did he say that? And how did he come, you know, to actually say that?
Well, that's a very good summary of the evidence. Thanks, Richard. Now, but was that enough in 1972 for the police to feel optimistic in filing a report saying that Clawdy was responsible, as a conclusive report?
And the answer to that is yes. On that basis, on nothing else but that, they have suggested to the church and to everybody else that Father Chesney was, in their opinion, guilty. And they wanted to arrest Father Chesney at the time. They wanted to go to his house because they had evidence, they say again, that he may have had weapons or explosives stashed in you know, where he was living. It was, I mean, it was on basically very flimsy evidence that the IOC based their conclusion, which they obviously jumped to, that Chesney was guilty.
So, the rule of law, you might say, was bent, if not broken there, by the British government. But who was affected by the decision to, shall we say, bend the legal process?
Well, the police ombudsman say that they have evidence that the rule of law, the process of law at the time in 72, was definitely ignored. And so the police are definitely guilty of doing that, and there's no denying that. But what was, was this to protect the Catholic Church, as they say? Was it to protect the Catholic priest that they say these things? Or was it to introduce potential bargaining power over the Church? Why did the Church believe the police? And why did the Church believe, when they colluded with Willie Whitelaw, that the police had sufficient evidence to treat Father Chesney in that way and basically bounce him around from one pillar to the next? And he ended up in Donegal eventually in 73. So obviously Father Chesney was never given, this is the problem, the opportunity to come forward officially and either deny or admit the allegations against him, the Church, but that were obviously being loaded against him by the RUC, particularly. It seems that the Church could have been misled, perhaps, by pressure from the RUC at the time. And we've got to remember that it says 1972, directly after Bloody Sunday. So there's probably a lot of pressure going around at that point.
Now, okay, what about the Catholic Church itself, though? Do you think that they may have evidence that they've simply not told the police about?
Yeah, I also downloaded something here from the net that the Catholic Church did not engage, this is what the Catholic Church says, that they did not engage in a cover-up in 72 with the IRA bombing, with the Clody bombing. Archbishop of Armagh, Sean Brady, and Bishop and Derry, Seamus Haggerty, both agreed on that point in a joint statement, which then followed the release of the police ombudsman report recently. And they said that the Church did not either prevent the possibility of the RUC arresting Father Chesney in 1972 for questioning as a suspect, which is what the police allege.
Now, you've mentioned the police ombudsman there. Who is the police ombudsman, and what's been the role in this investigation?
A police ombudsman's job or role is to investigate the criminal activity or the misconduct by the police. In this case, it would be the RUC in this matter. He says that the police ombudsman, that is Al Hutchinson, says that the police may well be guilty back in 72 of criminal activity and misconduct, therefore, but he will never know what their motives were. And so obviously we can assume that this implies further reason to question the motive of the RUC at the time when they accused Father Chesney with very little evidence. And so obviously we're going to be asking the police to and the Church to bring forward any further documentation, that's hard evidence that they might have, to verify and clarify why they were so sure that Father Chesney was guilty, as they suggested, and why they motivated the Church to treat him that way.
So, well, rather than an announcement in the press with flimsy evidence dressed up as facts, when will people involved in this Northern Ireland attack be given a clear and measured inquiry into the facts behind the Clody bombing?
Yeah, recently, now that this has come to light, since the 23rd and on the 24th, 25th, in the last three or four days, people have been obviously asking now that question. An inquiry, perhaps, or police investigation is needed to clear this confusion as to who was really behind the Clody bombings. What evidence against Father Chesney may exist to perhaps clarify some of this, because so far there's none. There's not really any evidence at all. The IRA have also not yet commented, particularly recently, or admitted the attack, and no official authority has seriously questioned that it wasn't part, for example, of the attack either. So it's very in the middle. So, I mean, Father Chesney died, by the way, in 1980, approximately 8 years after that incident, at the age of only 46 in County Donegal. I wonder if that's possibly related to pressure, stress, trauma, you know, that he must have been suffering from, because he didn't have a chance to deny or be officially questioned on the matter.
If I can just chip in, that the role of the police ombudsman in Northern Ireland has been developed as a result of this peace process. There wasn't one before. And of course, the ombudsman is there to investigate. Nuala O'Loan used to be in that role, and I've forgotten the name of the current incumbent, but you mentioned it earlier.
Al Hutchinson.
Al Hutchinson. I mean, the fact that there is some kind of independent investigation into these incidents from the past is partly as a result of this peace process. I think this is only one incident. I mean, obviously a horrifying incident where lots of innocent people died, and it's not surprising that the IRA never claimed responsibility for the attack and attempted to, if they were involved, to suggest that they weren't involved. I think probably what might be required in the longer term or in the medium term is some kind of commission that will look into all of these attacks, but not necessarily on a punitive basis. We've just pointed out that Father Chesney is dead, so there's no way that he's going to be punished other than by God. But the fact is that people still have a right to know what happened, and that if a process could be set up to investigate this and other incidents where people who come forward and say what evidence they've got, but not on the basis that they'll be prosecuted or imprisoned or whatever, but in order to get to the bottom of what actually happened for the sake of the people who died and their relatives.
Yeah, as Martin has said, clarity is definitely needed on this. The church themselves have possibly got documents from that period, 1972, that they might like to bring forward to clarify, because there's definitely confusion here, you know.
Well, the suggestion is that everybody covered up the fact that a priest was involved, because that would have been inflammatory. In 1972, you just had Bloody Sunday, Bloody Friday, there was sectarian massacres going on every day, and if a priest had been implicated in some kind of bomb attack, there was a possibility that would be throwing, whether he was or he wasn't, I mean, it would be, you know, that was the justification for the British government saying, well, let's just brush this quietly under the carpet. I think it's sufficient. There's so 40 years since has passed. I think it's now time for these things to be properly looked into with an open
and
mind.
Yet the Catholic Church recently have made a comment that they did not stop the police from questioning Father Chesney at the time, and yet Cardinal Conway has also made a statement which has been on the internet, and that he said. Whilst talking to Willie Whitelaw, he thought Father Chesney to be a very, quote, a very bad man, unquote. And why would he say that? And then, you know, move this guy, the Father Chesney, about three times. And it all sounds a bit, I don't know. But certainly illegal. They avoided the law. They should have questioned him.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's lots of incidents like this require investigation. I think we need to set up a process whereby all of these incidents can be looked at in an objective way without a vindictive spirit as well.
I mean, now, Martin, you're talking about the sort of Truth and Reconciliation Commission like they had in South Africa. Now, how did that actually work out? Did it prove to
be... Well, the way they ran it in South Africa was that if you come forward and say what you've been involved in, whatever side you're on, and you tell us the truth and the whole truth, then we will that will do. As long as we've got the truth out of you, we won't punish you. That's how we will deal with this. And that, in fact, encourages people to come forward, because you're saying, as long as you tell us everything, we won't punish you. So, for example, IRA people who were involved in the attack might be encouraged to come forward and say, well, actually, we know what happened there. It was this.
It's interesting to note that from 72 to 76, four other people died in Clawdy as well. Service personnel, two I think from the RUC and one from the UDR died, and they were killed by the IRA, and that has been admitted to. There was also a Catholic civilian killed, a fourth person that was also killed by the UFF in Clawdy. Funny thing is that Clawdy have actually seen a higher percentage of injuries and deaths, and it's only a very small village comparatively to the city of Belfast in the populace, if you compare the population.
Well, if nine people die in a bomb attack in a small village, it's going to have a big impact, isn't it?
Well, it's not just the nine. Then it's the other four that died. Yeah. Then there was the 30 that were injured. But, you know, yeah.
Anyway, Richard, thanks very much for that report. I think that's helped clarify some of the sort of almost like rumours that were going around earlier in the week about this guy being responsible for the attack. Well, Lib Dem leader Nick Clegg has been put in charge of the country. We hear an exclusive interview with BCFM and Nick Clegg after this. Christina and Curved Air from, oh gosh, a long time ago. Anyway, traditionally the month of August is the month when nothing happens in politics because Westminster's closed, Bristol City Council's closed, no meetings. John Peters Coleman from our sister programme Dialect drew the short straw. So, John, would you like just to tell us how you met Nick Clegg here in Bristol last weekend?
Certainly. He's been doing a tour around the country this month. He's acting PM this month because Cameron's away, obviously. So he's decided to spend his time as PM doing a sort of meet the people tour, question and answer sessions. He said he's done these historically a lot in the past and he finds them very useful. So he was in Bristol at the At Bristol Centre. I watched the hour-long question and answer session sort of passively as a media person. And then myself and Martin Summers got 5 minutes to have an interview with him in person.
Okay, so how did you? What did you think of his performance in front of this invited? Was it an invited audience? I think it was Heart FM that they chose for some reason to actually get the people in, which strikes me as a bit strange because I can't imagine people who are sort of very politically engaged being Heart FM listeners.
Well, I think his point is that, you know, everybody is politically engaged to a certain extent. Whether they're knowledgeable or not doesn't matter. I mean, politics affects everyone.
I suppose you can listen to music and be interested in politics, can't you?
Yes, this is very true. It's a distinct possibility. I mean, a lot of people there in the front row certainly were councillors. Martin recognised far more of them than I did. But yeah, there were a lot of councillors mysteriously turned up as members of the public, because obviously they want to, especially a lot of Liberals, because they all want to meet Nick Clegg. Fantastic.
Well, Martin, do you want to just give us some of your impressions of the meeting? Before
it was a fairly small meeting. I think a maximum 100, I think possibly less than that in the room.
Mm, not many.
And I did actually question, I mean, the thing that crossed my mind is who's actually flying the plane at the moment while you're answering these questions, because some of the questions were okay and some of them were basically time-wasting kind of questions, I felt.
Well, I don't think that's fair, is it? Because for everybody who's asking a question, it's not time-wasting from their point of view.
One does wonder what the Prime Minister is doing answering questions about people's personal lives in a meeting like this kind.
Can you give us an example of a question?
Well, no, I don't want to point the finger at people. I mean, I think what I wondered was, I mean, what crossed my mind is, isn't there something else for the Prime Minister to be doing at the moment? I mean, it was a Saturday, I suppose, and you could say he's been working all week. But, I mean, I think it's good that people should be accessible to the public. I just wonder, you know, who is actually minding the shop. That's the sort of thing that crossed my mind.
I mean, Westminster does know there is a problem with sort of PR and public relations, and politicians have this terrible reputation. And this is sort of a part of a long string of things where politicians turn up and try and seem more personable, and anybody can just ask them any question. But, for example, he's saying how much he cares about frontline services like the NHS. And there were a couple of nurses there who had been made redundant. And his response to that was typical of many of the responses, because he said, oh, well, I don't know about your personal circumstances. I'm very sorry to hear that. But it's like when you trace up, you know, the hierarchy of the NHS, you know, the PM is effectively the top man because it's a state organisation. And he didn't really have an answer to their question as such.
But he can't be expected to know every little minutiae and detail of these people's careers and why it is that...
As he said himself, he's not a walking encyclopedia, but his response is, oh, well, I don't really know about your personal circumstance, so I can't really say. So if anybody says, well, as a result of these cuts, I've been made redundant, his answer is, oh, well, I can't really make a comment about your personal circumstances. So he engages in the personal when the political is not, you know, he doesn't want to do that.
I think in a previous era, he would have been able to answer their questions because he would have been responsible, but of course the trusts which employ these nurses are not directly responsible to the Prime Minister, so he's able to say, well, I can't help you, you'll have to go back to your individual bosses.
The responsibility,
but of course the nurses weren't happy with that, because they're saying, look, I've been a nurse for 30 years, why am I being made redundant? And he's not actually able to answer the question, so that's a bit disappointing.
Yeah. Okay, well, without further ado, let's have a listen to our guest here, John Peters Coleman, having a chat to the Prime Minister, acting Prime Minister of the day, Nick Clegg.
I should point out, it's me, myself and Martin Summers. We put our heads together. What we were hoping for was three questions, maybe possibly four at the outset. I would give a nice warm-up, comfortable question to get him going. Martin would hit him with a hard economics question, and then hopefully I would follow up. We only managed two questions, though, but this is me and Martin.
This is John Peters Coleman and Martin Summers for BCFM. Nick Clegg, hello.
Hello.
In effect, you are the Prime Minister at the moment, because Cameron's on his holidays, and that would make you the first Liberal Prime Minister since the days of David Lloyd George back in the 1920s, and he was no stranger to coalitions. So if he was alive and he could look upon the coalition, how are you doing? How do you think he would do?
I would say, well, God, I don't know what David Lloyd George would say, and whatever he would say more colourfully and memorably than I think I can manage. But I think he'd say that, you know, we've hit the ground running, haven't we? I mean, this is a marathon, not a sprint. This is a parliament for 5 years. We're governing for the long term. We want to make changes, which, yes, are very difficult, certainly in the first few years, as we have to deal with a huge black hole in the public finances we've dealt with. But we've set out a plan. We've been very open with people about what that means. And I think, you know, in 5 years' time, I'd be able to say to Lloyd George that we've got a fairer, more balanced economy, you know, and a country where people are much more in charge of their own of their own lives. And I hope he would judge us kindly in 5 years' time.
Okay, so you definitely see the coalition as a long-term thing in its terms of survival.
For this parliament, yeah. I mean, we've been very open that we think that this government, this coalition government, needs 5 years to do the difficult things that we're setting out to do.
Okay. At that point, I'll hand over to Martin Summers.
Nick, as I understand it, the intellectual justification behind the cuts policy which is being pursued is that we must not lose our credit rating, and in a sense that the Standard & Poor's and Moody's and the credit agencies are actually vital part of the coalition's policy, in the sense that we mustn't upset them. But Standard & Poor's estimate that there's a 1 in 3 chance, and other independent economists think it much higher, that the cuts policy may lead to a double-dip recession. And of course, the implication of that being that a double-dip recession would increase the deficit, as happened in the early 1980s when Geoffrey Howe was Chancellor, and also lead to the loss of our credit rating. So that you could end up, in the worst possible case, with a triple whammy of a falling economy, a bigger deficit, and the loss of credit rating. And of course, we've got this happening on the other side of the Irish Sea, where a conventional-style economic policy has been pursued for the last 2 years, with that result. Now, in the past, in a previous generation, liberals like Keynes and Beveridge, I don't think they would have agreed with this cuts policy. And I don't think that conservative prime ministers of a previous generation like Macmillan or Heath would necessarily have agreed with it. And I suspect that what's happening is that people have remembered things from the 1980s and forgotten things from the 1930s. And I see the Liberal Party possibly having problems with this, because I don't think this is a liberal instinct to cut. You're justifying it as a necessary thing to do. I mean, how would you comment about all of those points that I've just made?
I disagree. This is not a policy taken to satisfy the credit rating agencies. Let's remember, actually, despite all that sound and fury in British politics, all parties, including the Labour Party, agree that you need to get to grips with the deficit. In fact, the Labour Party's own proposals were roughly, what, two-thirds of the cuts that we're proposing. Why? Why does everyone agree on this? I mean, the Labour Party has chosen to forget this. Why? Well, I think a number of reasons. Partly there's a moral dimension to this. I just don't think it's right for this generation to just hand over the debts of this generation to our children and grandchildren. There's a generational issue. You know, we've got a huge, huge legacy of debt, and simply, I think, ducking dealing with it is not right. I think we do need to wipe the slate clean. I think there are other reasons as well. If there is any doubt that we are going to get on top of our deficit, then of course the immediate consequences are that interest rates go up, you get less confidence, people sort of, you know, investing less money into UK PLC, you have less stability in order to create the jobs which you desperately need. I don't think comparisons with Ireland, frankly, make a huge amount of sense. They're in a very different situation. It's a much smaller economy, but crucially it's part of the Eurozone, so the effect on interest rates is quite different. Final point I was about, I really do disagree with the idea that, you know, being responsible with money is somehow an illiberal thing. It's a very old-fashioned liberal view that you shouldn't constantly, you know, live beyond your own means. The trick now is not certainly not turning the clock back to the 30s. Let's keep this in perspective. After the comprehensive spending round, we will still be spending £700 billion of your money, of taxpayers' money. That is a huge amount of money. The state won't be the size it was in the 1930s. It'll be, you know, the size it was just a few years ago. It's not turning the clock back. We're not going to repeat the mistakes of the 1980s. We're not going to uproot whole economies and industries and uproot whole communities. But we are, yes, having to take some difficult decisions to find some savings on a one-off basis to deal with this black hole so we can then move forward in a sustainable, fair way in the future.
Well, on behalf of both of us from BCFM, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye, Martin. Take care.
So that was Nick Clegg last Saturday, speaking exclusively to BCFM in the personage of John Peters-Coleman from Dialect Programme and also our very own Martin Summers. And I thought, Martin, that actually Nick Clegg came back rather swiftly to you there, didn't he? He was basically saying that you were suggesting that it was actually moral to hand on this massive deficit to our children. I think Nick was trying to steal the moral high ground from you, Martin, wasn't he?
Yes, because he didn't answer the substantial point, which is that the problem with the cuts policy is that it may in fact increase the deficit. So he was obfuscating that in his reply. The point I was making is that even the ratings agencies, and it's not just the ratings agencies, other independent economists are actually beginning to realise that the cuts policy will possibly lead to a double-dip recession and then an increase in the deficit. So not only... I didn't actually ask him any questions about the fairness of the policy, why should teachers pay for bankers' mistakes? I was just pointing out the rationality of the policy is in question. And, of course, what he did very cleverly was avoid answering that question, because, of course, that is the $64,000 question. Will it work? And of course, I suspect that, I mean, obviously, I believe that it won't work, and I'm not the only one. And I think he probably suspects that it won't work as well, but of course, he can't say so.
What I also found quite interesting was the way that he did point out, which a lot of people probably haven't picked up on, was the fact that Labour would probably have had to have put through cuts of their own, and were planning to.
Indeed.
Partly because I read a quote from the editor of the FT today, because I was reading something at work, and he said the financial markets do dictate government policy to the extent that if a financial, you know, if a person that's like the Chancellor tries to put through reforms that the city are not going to like, he's going to face a very heavy battle to be actually able to enact them at all. Which suggests, for example, as he's kind of insinuating, if Gordon Brown were to try to continue this policy of spending, he would have had to have stopped doing that anyway.
I think he would, yes, and I think that the Labour Party also entered into this Dutch auction of who can cut most from the budget. What needs to happen is an intellectual revolution by everybody to recognise that cuts will not actually achieve the goal which is being suggested. And we've seen this now in Ireland. Ireland have been cutting like mad in order to satisfy the financial markets, and instead of satisfying the financial markets have turned around and kicked them in the teeth. Now you may lose your credit rating anyway, but at least you won't crash your economy if you carry on spending. But if you crash the economy and lose your credit rating, I can't see that that has any merits, and I think that that's probably what's going to happen. The coalition may be right, and the private sector may be such a magic institution that it will magically rescue us from this Houdini like trap that we're in. I think that's just fantasy, though. I think in actual fact there are no easy options here, and cutting public expenditure sounds like a tough option, but it's also a stupid option, and it won't work.
And he also pointed out the extent to which they differed from the Tories, insofar as he said this is not going to be like the 80s where we uproot whole industries, which I thought was a little sly.
Do we have any industries left to uproot?
Yes.
Well, yeah, that's very true.
I mean, to my mind, it's all very well saying that, but the consequence of the policies could be exactly that. And it's no. You could say, well, we didn't intend to do that. Well, that's not really the point, is it? I mean, I'm sorry I went on quite long with my question, obviously. But of course, the point is that I'm trying to make an intellectual point about the intellectual viability of the policy, rather than just a political point about it's not fair to punish teachers for bankers, or you seem to be, you're turning your back on the poor or whatever, trying to take the moral high ground. What I was trying to get him to confront was the intellectual problems with cutting deficits. Because in the 1980s, The Thatcher government tried to cut the deficit. They were keen on cutting the deficit. They cut public expenditure. They chopped things back. But of course, as the economy went down as a result, the deficit got bigger. And that's exactly what's happened in Ireland. It's exactly what's happened in Greece. And it's exactly what will happen in Britain as well, unless there's an intellectual revolution and a realisation that this kind of orthodox policy can't work.
Now, moving on a little bit to Wednesday this week, we had a report by the Institute of Fiscal Studies. I don't know if you came across that one, Martin.
I did, yeah.
Which described the Condem budget as, that's George Osborne's budget, as regressive. That is to say, it's costing the poor proportionally more and the rich proportionally less. Now, ITN's Channel 4 News said that Clegg is more Sheriff of Nottingham than Robin Hood.
Well, that's right, but I mean, the point I was making in my question to him, others are making this point, that in actual fact, the poor are being made to pay the price for the sins of the rich. I mean, I can't remember that old song, it's the rich that gets the pleasure and the poor what gets the pain, or whatever it is, I can't remember how it is. I mean, certainly that's how it comes across, but that is not the most important point. Perhaps if the policy was going to work and to get the economy back on the right track, the pain might be justifiable, but if the pain is going to be inflicted and it's not even going to work, that's a much more serious point. And I think that it isn't going to work. What's happened is a whole generation of people have been brought up inside the universities learning a certain version of economics, which would have been, in my day, would have been regarded as basically silly. There's a whole generation of people have been brought up to believe in the free market, the efficient market hypothesis, etc. But what the last 2 years has shown is that it's all wrong, and that you've got to actually think of the economy in a different kind of way, in the kind of way that Keynes thought about it in the 30s, as an integrated whole. Because public expenditure cuts will, in fact, clobber the private sector. That's already becoming obvious. So you can't actually make the private sector work by cutting the public sector. It just doesn't work like that.
Okay, economics aside, I'm quite interested in the sort of personal side, John, of what it was like to actually meet the guy who's in charge of the country, and whether you felt he really was sort of at the helm, running things, if you got the sense that he was. Benjamin Disraeli, who was Prime Minister from 1874 to 1880, in his book Coningsby, said, and I quote, "The world is run by very different personages than it appears to those who are not themselves behind the scenes." So, as you had a little glimpse behind the scenes, did you really feel that Nick Clegg was the man who was really running the country on Saturday?
You do get the air, particularly with these circumstances of interviews, that the PR man or woman concerned is actually equally running the show as he, because, I mean, politicians, once they're stuck into the subject, I mean, I think Nick Clegg would, you know, you immediately answer back, and you wanted to answer back, "Oh, well, I just want to pick you up on tax or whatever," and weren't able to because his PR stopped him. I think Nick Clegg would have happy to have gone on all afternoon.
Did he have a public relations person hovering around
arguing
the
monkeys, but PRs like have to step in
her
and go,
name
"Yes,
was Charlotte."
Yeah. You know, they do have a talent for knowing, right, I better shut him up now and I'll cut it off.
Did she have a sort of on-off switch kind of thing almost?
Yeah, there's a sort of a button that links to some sort of electric device under the sofa or something, yeah. I think he's doing a very good job of hitting the ground running. I'll give him that. So, you know, that was the air. But obviously, I only saw him very short, you know, in a very brief period. But, you know, I'd be interested to watch his learning curve. I think it would be pretty steep.
What about you, Martin?
I think he's basically a decent bloke.
Yeah.
I mean, what I said to him is, I don't actually believe that you actually believe in cutting. You know, you're cutting because of a necessity.
He's not a decent bloke if he's cutting when he doesn't really think he should.
No, I think what's happened here, as Keynes said many years ago, even the most seemingly practical of men are usually the slaves of some defunct scribbler. And what's actually happened is that the people in charge, including Nick Clegg, have got a certain vision of the world which they've inculcated into themselves, and they all speak to each other, so they all kind of reinforce this vision of the world with each other, and it's just basically wrong. You can't cut your way out of a recession. In the 1930s, in the end of the 1930s, people understood that, and of course the government fought World War II. It wasn't the private sector that did it, and at the end of World War II, we sensibly decided that maybe the private sector wasn't the lead sector that it had always been perceived to be. And I think the future is a big public sector with a smaller private sector, and that people like Nick are going to have to accept that.
It's interesting, an American university did a study recently, which was reported in the last month or two. I think it was reported in the New Scientist. They wanted to examine why leaders want to lead in the first place, why are they motivated to do it, partly in response to public perception that, you know, people, politicians are all greedy and dirty and basically sort of borderline criminals. And they found that most people who lead do so out of a genuine desire to want to make positive change. And it did strike me as a man who does genuinely want to make a positive change, you know, he does genuinely want to do things, but I think he is a little bit bent over a barrel, so to speak.
Well, there are some people who are leaders who are invited to be leaders by a rather intriguing charity called Common Purpose, aren't they? They don't actually decide for themselves, they just get a sort of tap on the shoulder and say, "Right, we think you would make a good leader."
Yeah, okay.
Well, I think he's... Clegg is actually on the right of his own party, and in many, many respects, he and Cameron share many ideas. But there are many other people in the Liberal Party who don't really share those ideas, and actually, because of the history of the party, are actually quite opposed to public expenditure cuts. I don't want those people to leave the Liberal Party. I want to cooperate with them to try and build a more rational policy. And I was just testing him out to see if he was interested in that kind of approach. But I don't think he is. I think he's misguided, basically. This won't work. And it'll be very clear in the next 6 months. I mean, in the next 6 months, I'm on the radio now. If it works, I'll have to eat my hat, won't I?
Yeah.
But I don't think it will work. I'm pretty confident that I will not be eating my hat.
So, Martin, are you feeling ready to lead some sort of an intellectual revolution, as you were saying earlier on?
Well, I'm doing my bit. It's not just me. I mean, lots of other... I mean, Paul Krugman in the US and various other senior... Joe Stiglitz, various other senior US economists are saying, look, we must not cut public expenditure at the moment, because then we will crash the economy. And the problem with crashing the economy is you can't say, "Oh, we've crashed the economy, can we reverse the video now?" Because it's too late. You've crashed it, and the losses involved in crashing it are so great that then the options are then that much smaller. So this is a dangerous moment. If I was the Conservative leadership, I would have been very cautious about approaching the economy. I would have taken a steady as she goes approach. Let's not rock the boat here. But they're being very ideological about it. Not the Liberals, but the Conservatives being very ideological about it. And I think that the country as a whole is going to rue the day. We need pragmatism, not a lot of ideology.
Well, Martin Summers, Oxford economist, and John Peters Coleman from the Dialect Programme, thanks very much for that report on Nick Clegg.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now, from bombshells dropped by Martin Summers and bombs in Ireland to bombs in Iraq. Another massive bomb on Tuesday this week has killed 60 Iraqis and injured many more. Here is the report on that came out this week from the Associated Press, at least a little brief summary of it. Powerful blasts targeting security forces struck where they are supposed to be the safest, turning police stations into rubble and bringing down concrete walls erected to protect them from insurgents. Where is the protection? Where are the security troops? Said Abdu Mohammed, an eyewitness to a car bombing near Baghdad's Aidan Square that killed two passers-by as well. What is going on in this country? Iraq's foreign minister said insurgents are attempting to sow as much chaos as possible as lawmakers struggle to form a new government and Americans withdraw troops. And Iraqi leaders have failed to end the political impasse. Nobody immediately claimed responsibility for this particular blast, but they bore the hallmark, apparently, of Al-Qaeda. So, yet another massive bomb attack with scores of innocent Iraqis blown to pieces has taken place this week. It seems that these bombs are exploding more frequently now. The US Army has been replaced with various private military companies such as Blackwater's mercenaries. So, rather than the US troops being withdrawn, they've simply been replaced by private mercenary soldiers. The so-called private military companies are a very sensitive issue, it seems. One whistleblower from a PMC, as they're called, was announced at 10 a.m. in the beginning of a BBC Radio 5 Live's Victoria Derbyshire programme about 3 months ago, a whistleblower from a private military company. Although the item was announced at the start of the show, the whistleblower never actually appeared on the programme and no explanation was given. Indeed, no further mention was made of the item, and it was as if it had never existed at all. Anyway, Bristol is very lucky to have half-based here Sami Veliola, who founded the Humanitarian Liaison Centre in Kirkuk, Iraq. I say half-based here because Sami is half Bristolian and half Iraqi. I spoke to Sami about his role there in Kirkuk, where he approaches the US military on behalf of families where members of the family have simply disappeared. In other words, they may have been arrested or killed, but the family know nothing about them, and Sami attempts to locate them and, where possible, get them released from arbitrary arrest. Anyway, back to the big bombs, and it does seem extremely strange that Iraqis should be blowing up their own people in a futile attempt to fight the occupation. So if Iraqis are not planting these massive bombs, who is? The rumours which are constantly circulating in Iraq, which are very rarely heard over here, are that rather than squabbling Iraqi groups planting them, the occupying mercenaries are planting them, and then using the world media through official announcements and agencies like Associated Press and Reuters to blame them on insurgents or rival internal groups sometimes. There's also a strong possibility that suicide bombers may not be suicide bombers at all, simply innocent people who've had explosives planted on them by the occupation forces. Anyway, we're going to break that particular taboo tonight as we hear Sami Veliola tell one story he was told on fear of the witness's life, and also one incident that Sami experienced himself.
My name is Sami Veliola. I have founded the organization of Humanitarian Liaison Center in Kirkuk, Iraq. I went to Iraq taking medical aid and medicine in two trips. I'm Iraqi British, from Iraqi background. I've lived about 50% of my life in Iraq and the other 50% in Britain. And when they were determined to start the war in Iraq, supposedly to liberate Iraq from Saddam's regime, as they say, I knew something horrible going to happen. I knew there will be a lot of casualties over there and people are going to need some help. And I thought instinctively, like, to go with a group of friends that they are helping me in Bristol to go and collect aid and medicine. And one of the guys who came to me forward, like, he came forward to me to say, look, I'm ready to speak to you, but if you want, if you can get somebody to give you immunity to take me abroad, and I live there, I take a refuge there somewhere, because if this word gets out here, they kill me. He was working in a you know, the first telecommunication, mobile communication company, SSL, in Iraq. He works, let's say, the distance between Bristol and Bath. He works in a city just outside Kirkuk. He's a driver. He takes the people into work, and after hours, they bring them back into Kirkuk. The US Army, convoy of them, they stopped this about 10 cars on the way. They got the people out of the cars about 100 meters away, told them to keep their way away, their face away from the car, from their vehicles, while they carry out a search. So they sat down with their hands up, searched their vehicles, and then after about 10 minutes they said to them, right, it's nothing, 10, 15 minutes, you can go back to your cars, you're clear to go. Then what happened is, this is a minibus, the guys went back to their vehicles and the driver went to drive the car. One of the passengers said, well, my seat is not right, it's moving a bit, can you straighten it or something? He came down and he's looking at the seat, which is not like pushed down properly, one of those lifting seats. And he lifted the seat, loads of explosives underneath the seat. And he's like, what's happening? They came to search their vehicles, and after that, the explosives inside the car. So they take off and they dump, there's a river further down the road, they dump the explosives there, and he's scared for his life. He thinks those people, they'll be transported from the branch to the headquarters of the communication. So this vehicle would have been in that destination. When he arrives there, they would have triggered and blew it up. And the other incident was a police lieutenant. I was in that area, a specific area, that people, there's a petrol station further ahead, and those people, they are refusing to join the queue. They're trying to cheat. The Americans, they've taken about six or seven cars in a convoy. Hummers behind and Hummers ahead. And they're going, supposedly they're committed offense, and they're going to, trying to put them straight, you know. So they come to this area where I was in. One of the vehicles breaks down, and the American soldier gets out with the driver. They push the vehicle to the roadside, and in that road is a very busy road. They don't allow vehicles to stop there unless they know the owner where it is and if he's got a shop there or something like that. So not long after that, the police, they came, Iraqi police. Who's the owner of this car? Who's the owner of this car? Nobody can find the owner. So immediately they try to break the window of the car to search it. I came to the lieutenant, I said to him, I said, listen, officer, I said, the guy, the driver, has been taken by the Americans, so no need to smash or vandalize. Obviously the car broke down, I saw that, and they had taken the driver. I said, listen, my brother, I'm not trying to be horrible, but let me tell you something. Do you think the Americans are trustworthy? How would I know? They haven't agreed with this guy, or they've taken him somewhere else and they booby-trapped his car and they brought him here. I can't trust that. He called the headquarters. He said, this is my patch, this area. I do not want this vehicle, whether the Americans, whether the Israelis, anybody. I don't care whether the Iraqi government. I don't care. This car will be lifted from there, take it somewhere else. I have no trust in no Americans, no one. I only trust my instinct. This car was dumped. I don't know what they've done to the car. When it explodes, it's my responsibility.
Now, there was a famous incident where the British actually went in and took some SAS people, what was believed to be SAS people, who had been arrested by the Iraqi police. Do you know anything about that incident? Because I think we remember it was over a couple of days in the news here. It was a very strange thing because, first of all, the Iraqi police arrested them, mm-hmm. And then the British then came and actually attacked a house where he was being kept, smashed through the wall, and got these people out. So what was all that about? Can you explain?
Because there was a roadblock by the police. And this dressed in civilian SAS workers or soldiers, they try to push their way. The Iraqi police open fire. Not only they're civilians, so they don't have something written on their forehead or something. Oh, we're agents or we're working with the British Army. So they open fire on them. When they stopped, they've tried to clear that their way to say open the road for us, and I don't know what means and what they communicated with them. But when they refused, the Iraqi assault or Iraqi police, they refused. They opened fire and killed one of them, I think, at least. And then they shot off in their vehicles. Their vehicles are off-road vehicles as well, so they can take over any obstacles on the way. So they took off. Eventually, the Iraqi police caught up with them and arrested them, because of number of them, obviously. They took them to a prison in Basra, where British Army, that night, they decided they're going to drive the tank, reverse into the police station, and free them from the cells.
That was Sami Veliola, Bristolian from the Humanitarian Liaison Centre in Kirkuk, Iraq. Finally, Martin, can you just tell us, what with the mercenaries taking over from the troops, do you think it is actually feasible that this kind of thing is going on, that bombs are being planted?
Well, I think what we can say without fear of contradiction is that many people in Iraq are very suspicious about everything that happens. We don't know who planted those bombs. I certainly don't know sitting here. But many people in Iraq do not presume that they know either. And there's a lot of suspicion that the Israelis and the Americans and others may be planting the bombs in order to create trouble. And that's widely believed inside.
Okay, thanks very much, Martin. See you next week.